Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Alan Boston, who's renowned as both a sports bettor, primarily college basketball, and also a successful poker player, primarily seven-card stud. Alan Boston, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
I'm hoping you can hear me.
I'm hoping we can, too. Yeah. So far, sounds good.
All right, good. The microphone works.
All right.
I am not good with these things, so I had to call on some assistance hooking this up, and we have succeeded.
All right. Sounds like you're new to Skype, which is... You have a whole new adventure awaiting you. This is exciting for you, I'm sure. All right.
I'm new to Skype radio. Gambling-wise, it'd be a Skype. Anyway.
All right, Alan. There was a book written by Chad Millman, published 2001, called The Odds, One Season, Three Gamblers, and the Death of Their Las Vegas Dream. You were featured in that book. What was that all about?
Got a call from Joe Lupo at the Stardust. And he said, there's a gentleman named Chad Millman who had done an article on the opening line and how it was created. This is back in the days when the opening line to the Stardust mattered. And he was interested in doing a show about a real deal gambler. So they suggested me, having been one of the few remaining guys who did his own work and still ran around like, you know, it was the 1980s. Chad contacted me and came to visit me in Maine for a weekend, one of my last weekends in Maine. In fact, it was the opening night of Freaks and Geeks, which turned out to be my probably first or second favorite TV show of all time. I'm not sure if Deadwood took the lead or not, but anyway, we're getting off the beaten path. And at the end of that weekend, I told him I can't do it. And he said, but you're my whole book. I said, sorry, I've never been one to really stick my chest out, and it's really not my style. However, can you send me a copy of your first book? He co-wrote a book called The Pickup Artist, which was a history of playground basketball. I know Pete Axthelm wrote The City Game long before that, but that was more about the Knicks and the impact of basketball on New York City. This was the history of playground basketball. Having read the book, it was outstanding and very well written. And I said, okay. With a few things that we're going to have to leave out, like we're going to have to tweak the amount that's bet and, you know, not let people know that we actually do bet in the islands. We'll do it. And he would come to my house every other weekend during college basketball, and he knew nothing about gambling, so I had to kind of like teach along the way, and we'd sit there and we'd talk, and he'd just sit there and occasionally ask a question, but more often than not, just take it in and come with me when I ran around in bed and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He kind of immersed himself with me on every other weekend during the basketball season.
All right.
It was fun.
You know,
I always wanted to be a teacher, so it was kind of cool to be able to teach.
One of the things that was really interesting about that book is it really captured a moment in time when just at the end of when Vegas books sort of became irrelevant, or just before, right? Because in that book, the
just
islands...
Just as, are, I think.
The what?
It's maybe kind of, yeah, just as. Just as or just before, right?
Yeah, perfect. Just as. Because everybody, in the book, everybody is just starting to really wait and look for the lines that are coming from offshore, except Joe Lupo in the book, who still sort of has pride in putting up his line first, but... But then when the islands, if his line is wrong, basically, he would move it, you know.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Very sadly, because the Allen line was obviously a lot stronger than the local Vegas line, which made things a lot tougher. But at that time, we were a threesome, and we were betting rather large amounts. So manipulating a line wasn't all that difficult. So you could still get a price to where you wanted it, a la Mr. Walters. You know, he does it, obviously, on a much larger scale than I ever dreamed of. But, you know, I worked for him for a while, so I learned from him, too. And it was tougher, but it was still beatable. Now I'm not so sure it's even beatable anymore. So
really?
You're saying college basketball?
I think that was a missing chapter in Chad's book was, I said that, too, was how sportsbooks had changed over the last 10 years from, you know, and what that Don Best screen did to change the sports books. And I think that was kind of the missing chapter in the book that would have filled in the rest of the blanks and would have made people really understand why it was kind of the end of Las Vegas as a sports betting place.
Yeah, I mean, but you're saying that that was 15 years ago, and you've still been, have you still been winning for the last 15 years? I mean, I assume
I
you
did
have.
Not. I had my first losing year 2 years ago. My work was horrible. Last year, I also lost a little bit, but the work was excellent. And it's just the randomness was just overwhelming. And I'm not crying. You have to be objective if you're trying to do this for a living. You can't delude yourself into thinking that you know what you're doing by saying, oh, I took a bad beat. You know, I analyze virtually every game I bet. And back in the day when I first started, I did it with a purpose because I wanted to try to understand what thoughts worked and what thoughts didn't work. And now it was more just to see, you know, how bad am I running? Because I know what thoughts kind of worked and what kind of thoughts didn't work. And of course, that all changed too. So, but that's pumped you up for later in this conversation. So I don't think I'm going to do it this year. I was approached about doing a college basketball website, not necessarily geared towards gambling, but an information website, which gamblers obviously could use. And obviously my part of it would be the gambling part of it. Where sports betting, if not legalized, because it probably won't be legalized because, you know, the NFL has a piece of this DraftKings and ESPN has a piece of DraftKings and they're all making money hand over fist while they lobby against gambling. They actually own a piece of a gambling website, right?
Yeah.
How weird and how brutal is that? But so I'm not so sure that sports betting is ever going to be legalized, and I really don't think it should be. But where it is more okay to talk about it, where more and more networks actually say, well, you know, Westgate posts this price or so-and-so has this price, and, you know, ESPN disgustingly has touts on their insider thing, and it's okay to talk about gambling on sports now. It's not taboo like it was 20, 30 years ago. So trying to get ahead of the game and getting a website that is full of college basketball information while I'm still, you know, below 80 years old could work. And he contacted other people who are smarter than I am. And if he can get that off the ground, I'm going to do that. I think my days of betting college basketball are over. I indeed have moved to Connecticut. I plan on playing 7-card stud for a living. But college basketball is approaching, and I'm getting the itch a little bit. So I'd hate to just go out on a losing note. It really kind of, like, sickens me. But on the other hand, with the 30-second clock imminent and my last 2 years really not being good at all, 2 years ago really horrible, last year just unlucky, I'm not so sure it's worth all the aggravation for what you can make. I don't think it's a good gamble anymore. So you could be talking to a retired sports bettor.
An almost retired.
Albeit one who did rather well. I'm not complaining.
And does Connecticut, I mean, are there good 7-card stud games there? Is that why you moved there?
Yes,
or you
exactly.
Just wanted to get out of Vegas?
I wanted to get out of Vegas. I wanted to go to a place that had 7-card stud. Foxwoods has had stud for years and still has many, many games, all of which I'm sure are very beatable, unlike Florida, which really doesn't. And, you know, all the new places have no limit hold'em. That was the flavor of the month, and that's what TV promotes, and that's what stuck. Stud is a dead game. It really had very poor turnouts this year at the World Series. Really depressing, actually. because I really think it's, you know, obviously I think it's the best game. I think it's also maybe the toughest game, but that's for another day also.
Well, we're going to have poker questions for you, but let's not get off of college.
I'm not really a poker guy, though, but
well, we're going to have some
poker for many years and was very successful with the World Series for many years also. But that's why I moved to Connecticut, yes, to play seven-card stud.
All right. Okay. So if you did bet college basketball again, how much weight do you give the coach as opposed to the players? Which coaches are overrated in your mind and which ones are underrated?
Oh, wow. I haven't really looked at the work yet, but I'm very old school in how I do it, I do need to go here to answer this question. So I'm not ducking the question. It'll all make sense at the end. I assign a power rating to each team. In that power rating, the coach is kind of a part of it. It's like, how strong is this program with this coach? And the way I've always liked to explain it is like a golf handicap. You're a 10 handicap, you're a 10 handicap. You go and shoot 80 the next day, you're a 10 handicap. You shoot 70 the next day, you're a 10 handicap. Similarly, University of Pennsylvania under Fran Dunphy is going to play to a certain level year in and year out. And Duke under Coach K is going to play to a certain level year in and year out. You know, with little blips in the armor up and down, but mostly they're going to play to a overall rating of X. I don't know how coaches are rated, but certainly the ones that people think are gods that aren't any good. Well, Billy Donovan, who just got a job at a pro team, I think, Oklahoma City, maybe. I don't think much of him at all. I think he's borderline terrible. I don't think Calipari's very good. And
he's a hell of a recruiter.
When he didn't have the nuts, he kind of showed it. That year he lost in the NIT first round to Robert Morris. He was there saying, well, you know, when I get my players in, we'll see how these kids act. Like, well, he already had like three NBA players in that team and was losing in the first round at Robert Morris of the NIT. So, you know, I don't know how much talent he needs to win with. But if he couldn't win with that team last year, I would challenge anyone to tell me that he's a great coach. Those two off the top of my head, Roy Williams is abysmal. I think Bill Self is absolutely terrible. Most of the big name coaches, I think, are going to tend to be overrated. There is a reason for that. Most of them are good recruiters. If you're going to be a good recruiter, you're going to recruit the more athletic type player. If you're going to recruit the more athletic type player, you need to allow him to freelance a little bit. So a guy like Stu Moore, who I loved, who just retired from Utah State, who has flashcards on the side because he's running about 50 set plays and has about 20 different defenses that he changes every single time down the court, sometimes even during the set that they're running, he's not going to get, you know, McDonald's All-Americans, because he's teaching actual basketball. They're not allowed much freedom to, you know, break a guy down one-on-one and dunk on him. Whereas these other guys have to allow that somewhat to get that type player. So in some ways I'm being unfair to these guys, but the reality is that's what I watch and that's what I go on. I go on what I watch. And when Kentucky is running their half-court offense and it's basically a guy who's going to go to the NBA trying to break a guy down who's a good college basketball player one-on-one, I don't consider that running good offense. When Florida is on the verge of blowing Connecticut out 2 years ago and Connecticut goes five guards and Florida doesn't get it inside to happen to be like their best player, instead some guard shooting some three-pointer with 20 seconds left in the shot clock and their big lead quickly got away from them, that's not good coaching. When Michigan played Florida in the NCAA tournament and a guy hit a three-pointer from the same spot on four straight trips down the court, that's not good coaching. So, you know, I base things on what I watch, and most of the time it's going to be the big-name coaches who I'm knocking because, number one, they're the ones that are rated high, they're the ones that are easily more overrated. And number two,
they get on TV.
Their whole, like I just explained, to recruit good players means you have to coach a little less, I think, is a good succinct way of putting it.
You know, I want to go back a little bit. You mentioned Billy Walters, who you worked with for a number of years, and I just wanted to ask you about what that was like working with him and why did you stop?
He called me early one morning when I was working with someone else and said, Red, I think I got something good for us. I said, huh? Because, number one, how did he know me? And number two, how did he know that I was one of the handicappers that was causing all the mayhem on Monday morning? I was having a very good year in college football that year for some friends, and somehow they used the number of handicappers, but they used me the strongest, I guess, because I was having a good year. Eventually, they followed me a little stronger than their other guys, and they'd go out on Monday morning and destroy the market. And somehow he knew it was me. To this day, I don't know how. So we met at he wanted to meet at the country club. I said, I'm not a country club, Mr. Walters. Let's go to Ellis Island. And we met there. This is when Ellis Island was that sleazy bar before it was even a casino, but they had great food. And I didn't want him comfortable for whatever reason. And we talked, and he explained to me why I should work for him, and I told him basically, I don't think so. You're kind of condescending and megalomaniacal, and he said, I appreciate your honesty, Red, but, you know, at least think about it. I said, I will, sir. I called my friend Oscar, who's no longer with us, and he said, are you out of your bleeping mind? You know, tell him you want $20,000 a game. I said, what? I said, that's insane. I could never ask for that amount of money. So we met at the Sterling Brunch at Bally's. He brought his wife. We made a deal. The first year, I remember the second week of the deal. The deal is I would fax my plays over to him on Sunday nights. You know, let's say I'd want, just an example, game 118, NC State plus 3 for $3,200. Game 128, Maryland minus 6 for $1,800. Game 147, VPI minus 6.5 for $6,000 and minus 6 for $9,000, something like that, you know, up to whatever I could bet. Saturday, he would give me the list of the plays. Now, the bonus with him was if his guy was against me, I had the option of scratching my bet. If his guy was with me, I had the option of increasing my bet up until what my max bet was. So it was a very, very good situation for me to be in, where I'm never going to be against his handicapper, who obviously is terrific. I do remember the rules were I couldn't say anything to anybody. That was the only rule. Keep your mouth shut. Okay, I'm pretty good at that. But I wasn't quite good enough. Saturday morning, a friend from Philly, who I knew from college, he bet $50 a game max. And I knew that for a fact. And I would tell him what I liked on Saturday. And 1 week, I got a call from Mr. Walters. Red, you giving anyone the games? I said, no, not even my father. I said, wait a minute. I do have a friend in Philly who I do give the games to, but Mr. Walters, he only bets like $50 a game. He said, Red, give him this list today. So I gave him the list that he asked me to give him, which wasn't necessarily the list of what I liked. 45 minutes later, I get a call. Red, Mr. Steve Z and them, they just went out the following list of games. And, of course, it was the list of games that I had given my friend. And I'm like, I don't believe this. Like, so I called my friend screaming. I said, are you trying to get me fired? Are you trying to eliminate my livelihood? I told you, under no circumstances can you tell anyone what I'm doing. And don't deny that you are, because I know you are. I don't know who you're telling, but you're telling someone who's telling someone who's telling someone. And he admitted that he was telling Myron, who's an ex-college basketball referee, who's friends with Steve Z, who's an old sports bettor who doesn't really bet sports anymore. And they were going out and betting the games. Now, again, Mr. Walters played detective and came up with it. So I learned my lesson real quick that we don't say a word to anybody about anything at any time. And it's a good lesson for all gamblers to know. Just keep your mouth shut. Don't brag about how good you're doing. Don't tell anyone what you're doing unless, you know, they're real close friends of yours, et cetera, et cetera. Other than that, it was a very easy go of it. I would give him my list. Saturday morning, he'd tell me what I had. He'd tell me, you have an option of being on or against this. We're on the other side. Tell me what you want to do. And it was nothing but positivity. I think we had one time where I said, you know, I think you could do a little better on the numbers. And he said, I'll try a little harder next week, Red. And from that point on, we never had a problem. I think for 12 straight years, I won every year with him and had nothing but positive things to say. He was very honorable, very straight shooter. The first year I was ahead about, I remember I had about $80,000 going into bowl day. I mean, this is when they only had like 4 or 5 bowl games, and they're all on New Year's Day. This is how far back we're going. And I went like 0-5 and blew my whole year's profit. And, he talked to me like a father. You know, I came to town and got drunk one night at the Horseshoe and went broke and, told me stories about how he's come back from the depths of brokenness, and I will too. And in fact, I did. So really, nothing but positive experience. There was a summer in Maine. I went to Maine every summer. And I was with a young lady one night. We're having dinner. And I told Mindy, I said, you know what? I'm kind of dreading this football season. And she said, well, do you need the money? I said, well, no, but yes, but no. And she said, life is short. And I went home and threw out all my notebooks. And I called Mr. Walters up the next day. And I said, Mr. Walters, I don't think I can put the appropriate amount of time and energy into the work to make it fair for both of us. You're giving me way too much. He was giving me a salary too, to live on, and a pretty good free roll. I said, I don't think I'm going to be able to devote enough time and energy, and I don't think I have the fervor to do the work well enough to warrant what you're giving me. So thank you so much. It's been a blast over the years, and I'll check in when I get to Vegas. He said, Red, thank you so much for being honest, and you're a stand-up guy. Thank you. And that's how it ended. Like, I'm the only moron that would give up a free roll because he didn't think he could do the work appropriately. But
no, but that's, yeah.
That's my old school soul shining through, and that'll never change.
Now, you mentioned the notebooks, and they mentioned that a lot in the book, too, that you have all these three-ring notebooks with all your – did you ever evolve, past that, get into
using
a computer?
Yes, I went from two notebooks to one.
I found
a bigger three-ring binder. So here's the deal. I went to University of Pennsylvania. It's 1976 to 1980. The Palestra was their home floor. They had doubleheaders a couple times a week there. By the way, one admission paid for both games. Penn made the Final Four while I was there. This was real serious basketball. There was also a local store that carried the New York Daily News. I'm a Bostonian, but the New York Daily News was a cool newspaper. In the New York Daily News was a little column called The Latest Line by a gentleman named Jim McCarthy. Jim McCarthy wrote these alliterative blurbs where he picked these college basketball games. And now remember, this is the late 70s. There's no computers. There's no internet. You can barely make a phone call with a good connection. I had to bend the antenna to get Jeopardy on during the day. You know, this is real. This is how far technology's come and how fast it's come. But there was very little way, there was very difficult to access information back then. And I'm thinking to myself, how in the world does this guy know who's going to win the Wichita State Creighton game when he lives in New York? You can't even get a score in the game, you know, unless you listen to WINS and maybe they'd throw the score in once in a while, or you called Sports Phone, which, by the way, there was a great article on Sports Phone in Heartland, I think it's called. Great article, well worth reading. That's how you used to call 976-1313 every 10 minutes for the updates. And if you called a minute early, you pissed away like 25 cents because it was a charge for every long-distance call. So it was the only way to get scores. Or WINS 1010 and on your dial, quarter past the hour, they gave scores. And I think CBS Radio gave scores at 12 past the hour. Boston didn't have anyone that updated college scores nightly, hourly. So we're talking like the dark ages. Yet these guys, these so-called wise guys, knew who was going to win these college basketball games. And even back then, the term wise guy, which I think is anachronistic now. I don't even think it's a term that you can use anymore. But if you could, it's just a guy who can pick winners. And back then, I was intrigued. Like, how in the world did they know who's going to win these games? You can't even get a score in these games. 1981, a book called The Handicapper comes out by a guy named Robert Kalich. Page one of The Handicapper is the man. He's the guy who picks all the winners. And he gets this manic influx of phone calls where he's getting information from all over the country. And he puts it all together, and let's say, to be a little more modern, he plugs it into his internal database and spits out winners. And I said, you know what? I want to be that guy someday. long story short, I had a little problem with the law in Boston. I had a guy I'd met at a poker tournament. We got friendly, a guy named Jeff. And he said, if you ever feel like, come out to Vegas, we'll make some money together. I didn't know what making money together meant, but I was told to get the hell out of Dodge. So I was listening. That summer, I went to a bar every night and created my own power ratings on college football teams. Very, very simplistic way, and in retrospect, probably not a very good way. But I took final scores in the year before, and I kind of winged it. I then bought the Sporting News College Football to preview the year coming up and tweaked those ratings. I called Jeff up. I said, the Stardust puts a lineup at 6 o'clock on Sunday night. There's 8 games this week. Here's what I made the 8 games. And I remember one of them very, very, to this day, we bet Washington State +6 against Illinois. I remember he bet $800 on it because he gave me $300 of it. And the game closed, Washington State pick and won. And I'm like, you know, I felt like a genius. Like, how good are we? We got +6 and the game's pick and won. And that's, you know, they moved a lot back then. The lines were obviously a lot softer. And I felt like a genius. Every game moved my way. And so on throughout the whole year, every line moved my way. And I just had a good knack for doing it. And I then created my ratings for college basketball. And it just escalated from there. Eventually, some friends put up some money. We went three-way partners, and, you know, the more you win, the more you bet, and it got to be a pretty successful endeavor. That has not been the case the last couple of years, and I'm the first to admit it. I'm not as good as I once was, or maybe I'm better than I am, and it's just too tough a game. And it might be time to quit. But I was born and raised in an era where there were no computers, there were no spreadsheets. And I had to figure out my way of doing it. My way of doing it was writing it all. I actually hired someone to handwrite all the schedules. And when I first got to Vegas, I would plant myself, usually at the Stardust with a bunch of guys, and watch the sports ticker all night, every night. So the flow of the game became very important in my approach to handicapping. Why? Because I didn't know any other way. That's what I figured as the best approach, given what I had available. So every night I was at the Stardust watching the sports ticker, and believe me, I knew every update of every game that went on. And that gave me a pretty good edge on a lot of guys, because I would know if this team had a 20-point lead at any point during the game. I would know if this team in a really tough spot would make this, you know, 10-point spurt to get close before they got blown out again. You know, that little move with 8 minutes to go and the game's over, yet they got back to within 2 somehow. And now you know when this team's a home dog that if they could put forth all that energy, you know, they might just carry it all the way through with the home crowd behind them. So it was all little stuff like that, little bits of logic that I would take from the flow of the game. And as I told Chad, I tried to get inside each team. I tried to become each team. Is it going to be their night to play well? Is it not going to be their night to play well? And that's how I did it for years, and did it very successfully for years like that. Now, at some point, that didn't work. At some point, there were no clinkers for teams. Teams did not come out flat. And if they did, it was for a very brief period of time. And a few $100,000 later, I figured out, I can give you my reason why I think that happened. College basketball obviously became this huge money operation. It became a big business. Back when I was a kid, kids played football in the winter, football in the fall, hockey in the winter, and baseball in the spring. They'd letter in 3 different sports. Now, kids pick a sport and go with it. The gym wasn't as relevant. These guys use the gym no matter what sport they play. You can play badminton, and you're in there working out. They're much more athletic now. They're much more, I hate to be cliched, but well-oiled machines. Their sole goal every night is to go out and play as hard as they can for as long as they can. It's no longer a game that kids played. They go to college and play basketball for the love of the game. It's now a big money business where if these kids aren't playing their tails off 100%, the coach is risking his $500,000 a year job. So kids no longer come out a little flat. There's no more apathy. Yes, you get the home run effort where a team has their whole season on the line and they play a little harder. But those are few and far between. So my style of handicapping became anachronistic. It's antiquated, and I had to become more of a power rating type guy, where my number became more important than my feel. And once that happened, I lost my edge. And don't get me wrong, 3 years ago I had the best year I've ever had in my life. More games than I ever have by a mile.
Alan, you're starting to break up. Are you in one place or are you on a phone?
I am sitting in a chair speaking into a microphone.
Huh.
All right, so I guess we just go with this.
Sorry. I'm not very good with I don't have a very good connection in this apartment either, so
yeah,
so
that,
maybe the
that
connection's
seemed,
wavering in and out.
Yeah, that's
what did you miss?
No, we didn't miss it. Some of it was a bit distorted, but that's okay.
Sorry.
Have you invested?
So anyway, yeah. So 3 years ago, in spite of all this, I still had a home run year, like the best year ever. But the last 2 years, I haven't. And when you're a guy who relies on feel, and when I mean feel, I mean they put a lineup, and Arizona State's 3 over UCLA, and automatically my gut says bet Arizona State. And your gut is your highest level. It's your instinct. It's based on some inner memory, some old thing that you've seen before that's worked. Sometimes I couldn't even verbalize why I liked the game, but my gut was telling me to bet it, and my gut was rarely, if ever, wrong. Once I lost that feel, I lost a lot and was really surprised at how well I did 3 years ago, but it all came crashing back the last 2 years. I'm a dinosaur.
Have you investigated DFS at all?
Never heard of it.
Daily Fantasy.
No, not at all.
Okay. One of our listeners sent us a story, and they said, ask him about when he was crossing the street between the Riviera and the Stardust, and somebody attacked him. Is that a story you can tell on the air?
Yeah, I don't know what he's happy to hear that I got clubbed in the head by two guys by some metal object, but we were doing something called Beat Boston, which was a contest that Jimmy Vaccaro put on, and I actually lost $15,000 on this contest and got a separated shoulder and concussion for my troubles. But, you know, Mr. Vaccaro was always a gentleman, always someone I respected. If he asked me to do a favor, I did it. And we laid $30,000 to $20,000 against some tout from Alabama. I forget his name. Really nice guy. And we actually filled up the Riviera Racing Sportsbook every week. It was quite the internet sensation, this show. The first week, we gave out 5 picks each. Now, come Saturday morning, and that is a song by, I forget who, the Sandpipers, I think. Come Saturday morning. I think it's Sandpipers. Anyway, a stupid reference. We'll skip the stupid references in the future. Anyway, Saturday morning, every game I like is being slammed. Now, it actually worked out well this particular Saturday morning because my best bet was Cincinnati minus 2.5 against Marquette. And it kept going from 2.5 to 3 at Chris. Now, I had to wait till there was a market to get our bet down. So I kept taking 3 at Chris to get it back to 2.5. And someone kept playing it back, and I kept taking it. 2.5 in time where we can get our bet down. At minus 2, minus 20, by the way. And voila, the game falls 3. So I won like 10 extra thousand or 12, I forget how much. We won a lot of money because I had to get off the plus 3 that I had taken to get our bet to what we wanted. But the bad news was I could no longer give the bets out that I really liked on that show because obviously someone was investing some money on them before I had a chance to make my bet. So
you can't bet first.
Sucked. I ended up losing that contest and lost $15,000 in the process. And Leroy's lost $15,000 also. But oh well, I probably laid a little too big a price. But it was over 8 weeks. It was 40 picks. I think given equal circumstance, it wasn't the worst bet I've ever made in my life. It wasn't a great bet though. And he learned actually. He was a really nice guy. Strangely enough though, the guys who backed him, you know, he was hanging out with us. Like, don't you have your friends here? He said, no, they took off. Like, that's real nice. I mean, you're flying in from Alabama, you know, trying to win this contest for him, and then they're not even, like, being good hosts. So we took him to Ollie's. Our friend John Esposito owned this bar called Ollie's on Decatur and Blue Diamond. Had great ribs back when I actually ate ribs. Anyway, so that's what happened. One day I was walking across the street, and two guys jumped me. I didn't see him, or else it wouldn't have happened. I assure you it wouldn't have happened if I saw him. And according to the witness, one of them had a metal object, which he clubbed me on the head with. They did not take the $5,000 that was in my pocket. I walked into the Riviera, and Mr. Vaccaro was there. What happened to you? I said, nothing. I'm here to do a radio show. He said, no, you're not. As I'm bleeding everywhere and have a knot on my head about 6 inches out. And we canceled the show that week. I do have a cute story. Later on, I had my personal trainer. He would come to the show every week. And I had this physio ball that we were doing an exercise on one day. And at the 8:30 break, I said, we're going to do a little commercial in case this show gets big. And at the 8:30 break, I said, the reason I'm alive today is because this personal trainer got me in such good shape that I was able to absorb a blow to the head that would kill a lot of people. And let me introduce you to Matt Anthony, my personal trainer. And he's going to help with a commercial. If Pete Boston ever makes it big, I want to make sure we're prepared and have this commercial. So I put the physio ball down, which is that big round ball that people do exercises on, and I kneeled. I was able to kneel on it. I was actually able to stand on it, but this time I was just kneeling on it. And he took a foam roller and wound up and whacked me as hard as he could. That was the exercise. The exercise was for me to stabilize myself as he hit me with that foam roller on the physio ball. It was a core exercise. It actually worked the inner abs. It was really good exercise. But there's our Beat Boston commercial, right? Anyway, so yeah, that's the Beat Boston story. So yeah, it's kind of like there's better questions to ask than that. I recovered very quickly, and
well, the asker actually implied that you knew who had done it to you, that it was not a random.
Absolutely no idea to this day. Okay. They never said anything. I made that clear that they didn't even say this is from so and so. I wasn't screwing anyone's wife. I had never robbed anyone or cheated anyone. The only thing I came up with is I was wearing a Full Tilt hoodie and a Full Tilt beanie, and perhaps someone felt I was in their gang territory. That's the only thing I came up with. Because trust me, I have never screwed anyone out of a dollar in my entire lifetime and never will, intentionally anyway.
Huh, I didn't realize walking across the street from between the Stardust and Riviera was gangland. All right. We have about 5 minutes before we need to go to commercials. If you were
there to hit someone on the head.
Yeah, well, it's actually, that sounds like a fun job. I would like to be the guy who hit somebody standing on this physio ball. That sounds like it'd be a fun job to have.
Yeah, my wife would like that exercise, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. Would she prefer that it was you on the ball?
Yes, yeah.
All right, so if you were betting sports in Las Vegas, which are the best sports books and which are the worst and why?
Looks like we've lost a connection.
Yeah, we lost a connection.
All right.
I'll try to get back for you on his end.
Yeah.
All right.
Technology.
So, tell you what, why don't we run a few commercials now, a little bit early, and then we hope to get him back. And our producer will tell him if he does come back that we're doing the commercials early and we'll talk to him later. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. Every Thursday in September, they're going to have drawings at 8:15 p.m. where 25 people will spin the big wheel in the showroom. On this wheel, there are 20 positions. The 10 worst positions give out $1,000. 8 positions give $5,000, and one each for $10,000 and $25,000. That means half the time you win $5,000 or more. To earn the tickets, all you have to do is play. Video poker players earn one virtual ticket per dollar coin in, up to 1,600 tickets per day. Slot players earn tickets at three times that rate, up to the same limit. On Thursdays, you may earn 1,600 tickets before the drawing and an additional 1,600 after the drawing. It's a low roller drawing, which favors players who can go in and play $1,600 worth every day. Still, with 25 winners each week, an average prize of more than $4,000, it's likely that I'm participating in it. They did forget to draw my name last Thursday, but I will be there in a couple nights and hope that changes. The free video poker classes, which will be tomorrow, Wednesday, is beginner double bonus, and then at noon, and at 2, beginner double-double bonus. These are taught at the beginner level for a couple of reasons. One, the South Point does not have the 100% game. The games they have are approximately 99%. The reason they have these is Michael Gaughan has the philosophy that he wants all games treated equally, and he doesn't like the idea of penalizing players for playing certain games. So we're going to be teaching the 99% level. They also have a big variance between them in terms of how much you get between the straight and the flush, and it really affects the strategy. Also, later in the semester, we're going to be teaching double-double bonus quick quads, which uses quite a bit of the double-double bonus strategy. And also, we're going to be teaching double-double bonus ultimate X, which is played very much like the double bonus. So if players are coming to later classes, tomorrow's a good one to come to for the earlier classes. At the Palms, every Friday night, they have drawings. 10 people are called. You have up to midnight to collect your money. If you don't collect it, it is forfeited. They have multiple drawing entries on Friday afternoon and also Friday evening. Play for prizes. For the next 2 weeks, you earn fresh and easy gift cards. These cards may be earned and redeemed Monday through Friday, up to $190 on each of the days at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your points. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month, $79.95 a year, it allows you to get correction on most of the games, including Quick Quads. Quick Quads is my favorite game to play. It is the one I play on Double Point Day. And we're actually going to be teaching Quick Quads 8 days from now. The game of the week is 100 Play with Quick Quads. This is the ultimate game if you can find a pay schedule that pays well. Quick Quads is a game which pays 6 coins per line. And every time you get a hand like 10, 10, 10 with a 6, 4, where the 6 and the 4 add up to 10, it counts as 4 of a kind and makes an intriguing sound. So on 100 Play, it is about as much fun as you can get in video poker. All right.
I think we have him back.
Do we have, Alan, do we hear you?
Yeah, no, I lost the internet. The internet went kaplooey.
Well, good. So good. We did commercials, so we're fine now. So the question we asked before you went away was which are the best sports books in Las Vegas and why?
I thought I was in the middle of some long-winded story that.
Well, whatever that particular long-winded story we missed. We've had some others, but that one we missed.
Shit, it was a good one.
All right, can you duplicate it?
The best sports books in Nevada.
Okay.
Presently or
now?
Yeah, currently.
Now. Currently, I'd say the Red Rock, the Station.
Stations.
Really?
How do you like that, Art Man Terrace?
I find that hard to believe. I mean, they don't take much action at all.
Yeah, they do. They take $3,000 on a college basketball game. They take the same bet from everybody. Whatever their limit is. They don't change lines without a bet. They're very consistent in what they do at all times. It's not like when I go to Cantor and I go to the Palms and they decide what they want to take. 1,200 one day, 12,000 the next day. I mean, who needs it? Here's the limit. Here's what you can bet. Here's what Joe Cease can bet. Here's what Stan Roth can bet. Here's what anyone can bet. And they could have 6, and the rest of the screen could have 4.5, and they're not going to move it to 5 to be in line with everybody else. So they book kind of old school, and you know, they have a lot of locals action, which makes it a softer line. And I think they're the best. I never had one problem at the Stations, not one.
I would agree that Cantor would be my least favorite in town.
Coast is my least favorite. I hate to say it, but
what's your least favorite?
Coast.
The coast.
Gold Coast, yeah. Orleans, yeah. Samstown. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Sorry, Scooch. I had a conversation with him. I ran into some college football games one day. So they took 5,000 on one, which I thought was their limit. Then I asked for five on the next one. They said, we'll give you three on that. I said, okay. And then I asked for Tulane plus Rice plus three against Tulane or whatever the hell it was. And they said, we'll give you 1,000 on that. I said, excuse me?
Yeah, that 1,000. Seems pretty bizarre.
So I called Scoochie up. I said, listen, you know, whatever your limit is, that's your choice. But please don't change it midstream, mid-bets. Tell me what I can bet, and I'll come in there and gladly bet every single week. But if you're going to make a decision at the window based on what's around on the game, I can't come in there and give you any action. Sorry, Boston. We'll have a sheet printed out. Don't you know the next week I go there, and we agree 3,000 is what he's going to give me. That's fine. That's fair. You know, whatever it is, I'm not looking to bet $1 million on anything anyway. So I bet 3,000 on some game, and now I go to bet 3,000 on, I think it was Utah State against Colorado State, maybe. And they said you could have two. So I said, you know what? And I can't say what I told him because it'd get bleeped on your radio. And
well, I think we can imagine what you told him.
Yeah. And that was it. And I never bet there again. Actually, I did bet there because I live 1 minute from the place. I bet horses there once in a while. They're very nice people at the Suncoast. Very, very nice. But that's just insane. When I get off the phone with the boss and we agree that he's going to take 3,000 on every football game at least, and he'll offer me more if they need it. And then the very first week out of the box, no, you can have two. Like, give me a break. So they were my least favorite.
Yeah. And we didn't even get to talk about horses, but do you still own horses?
No.
You got over that vice, huh?
It's, you know, my dad pulled me out of a Little League game to go watch his horse race one night. And my parents split when I was in ninth grade. And I became this real bitter, inward, introverted, cynical, miserable human. But I found some solace at the racetrack where my dad used to take me. So harness racing is a love of mine, actually. And if I could afford it, I would still own harness horses, especially now where they actually race for giant money because of slot machines. The industry itself is completely dead. The racing's terrible everywhere. I was actually going to try to bet Northfield and earn a living betting Northfield, but the racing got real, real, real ugly there. And in spite of me calling the judges and telling them, you know, there are rules to be followed and you're not following them there, it didn't help. So it's going to be seven-card stud. It's not going to be harness racing. It's not going to be sports. It's going to be seven-card stud. But I love harness racing. If I had to do one thing with my life, it would be to bet harness race. I like that more than anything in the world. That's what got me to Maine every summer, was Scarborough Downs. I went there one night. We're racing a horse there, and it was absolutely beautiful. And that was my way away from my parents.
All right. You mentioned Seven Card Stud a couple times. You played Seven Card Stud in Vegas against some pretty colorful characters. Chip Reese and Danny Robinson for two. Both have gone.
We just lost him again.
We just lost him again, huh?
Yeah, he needs a better internet connection up there.
All right, so then I'm going to ask a question for Richard. And if Alan comes back, tell him we'll contact him in the future and we'll book him for another show, but we don't have time for any more questions today. All right, so, Richard, we got an email. A guy said he would be a very good player on a blackjack team, and because he has all these great skills, and he wants you to tell him how to find who's running a blackjack team and looking for members. So you must get these questions all the time.
I was going to say, I get this question a lot, and you know, the teams I know of, they just don't work that way. I don't know anybody who says, you know, let's put an ad in the newspaper and try to recruit team members.
John Chang did that at MIT. He did post signs up on...
Yeah, he posted around the school. But, I would say if you're interested in joining a team, you should it should happen organically. You know, you go out, you play, you start to meet people at the tables, you form friendships, you find, you know, people that you connect with, and maybe you end up teaming up with them. But you know, but you're not going to find teams that are just recruiting for random players to join them. So looks like we may have Alan back on the line. Alan, are you there? Yeah. Oh.
All right, Alan, we got about 2 minutes.
All right. Well, hopefully it won't screw up in the last 2 minutes.
All right.
Sorry about this, but I have no control over it.
The World Series of Poker, the final nine, is coming in about 5 weeks or something like that. Do you know who's there? Who do you like?
I know nothing about it. Sorry.
All right.
I think poker is doomed until they start reducing some rakes.
All right. So
for instance, when the horseshoe ran it, there was no rake. There was a little card fee. Even the main event was 10,000 in, 10,000 out. No rake at all, and they paid for all the food. The chop is just getting insane, and there's only so much money in the world, and the poker pool is being shrunk by all the money that's being taken out by these casinos. Okay. I understand they have to earn a living, but they're gonna ruin the game ultimately.
All right. Now they're voting now for the Poker Hall of Fame. Do you have any favorites in that?
Who's eligible? Jennifer Harmon, I think, should be in there.
Jennifer Harmon is definitely on the list.
I would vote her number one. She's the most relevant female player. She played the biggest limits. She was part of Full Tilt. Take it or leave it, Full Tilt was an important thing in poker.
All right.
She plays in the biggest games.
Okay.
And beats him. Plus, I really like her, so.
Oh, good. Now, John Juanda, Carlos Mortensen.
No, absolutely not.
Max and Pescatore.
I'm not going to go into why. I don't like him. And
okay.
I have my reasons.
Devilfish Ulliott.
You know, as a character, yes. As a poker player, I'm not so sure. He definitely was a name player before poker became big and remained that way after. So for that reason, he's certainly a possibility. But Doyle Brunson, who I respect quite a bit, always felt that to be in the Hall of Fame, you should be playing in the biggest games and beating them. And I always thought that was a good guideline to go by. So a guy like who's that clown they put in there who was the anti-smoking guy? McAvoy, I mean, what is he doing in the Poker Hall of Fame, really? The guy's never done anything in his life. He won some 50-man event or something. Can't play a lick.
All right.
Is totally irrelevant. So I would
Alan, we're out of time.
Yeah,
we actually...
I wasn't trying to bash anyone. I was just being honest.
Very good. No, we appreciate that. You answered our questions, and we'll have you on again once you get your internet connection fixed.
Or maybe we'll use a phone line next time.
Yeah, maybe we'll use a phone line next time. I'm gonna get a house phone line, which will make it a lot easier.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Alan Boston.
I hope you enjoyed it.
We did.
Cheers.
All right. So thank you, Alan. Richard, thank you very much. And go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge. Money.